Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. I'm Stephen Adler. I'm the provost of Earl Warren College here at UC San Diego, also a professor in the Department of Theater and Dance. And by virtue of my appointment as provost at Warren College, I'm the faculty director of the Law and Society program. On behalf of Chancellor Marianne Fox, Senior Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs Paul Drake, Dean of Arts and Humanities Seth Lehrer, Dean of Social Sciences Jeff Ellman, and Dean of the California Western School of Law Stephen R. Smith, I welcome you to the DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture, sponsored by Earl Warren College, the Law and Society Program, and California Western. The Higgs Lecture, presented at UC San Diego annually, provides the communities here at UCSD and Cal Western and San Diego with an evening of what we hope will be stimulating discourse on a vital contemporary legal issue. We believe that tonight's presentation by David Iglesias will accomplish the goals of the Higgs Lecture in exemplary fashion. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's program moderator, Professor Robert Horowitz of UC San Diego's Department of Communication and a member of the Law and Society faculty. Professor Horowitz received his PhD in sociology from Brandeis University. His areas of focus include democracy, the state, and political reform. Professor Horowitz also has an abiding interest in American free speech and communication law. His current work examines how the religious right and neoconservatives have shaped American foreign policy post 9/11. And Professor Horowitz will explain the rest of the evening to you in due course. Professor Horowitz, and thank you very much, and welcome to the Higgs Lecture.
United States attorneys are the field representatives of the U.S. Department of Justice. They decide which cases get sent to trial. There are 93 of them, usually one to a state, although in heavily populated states there are more. They typically run large offices with large numbers of prosecutors. Appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, U.S. attorneys generally reflect the legal and political philosophy of the presidential administration. They serve in the lingo at the pleasure of the president. They can be removed by the president, and with a change of presidential administrations, they usually are. There's usually a clean sweep, and U.S. attorneys appointed under the previous administration are let go, and a new cohort is appointed. As such, U.S. attorneys are in some respects part of the traditional spoils system in American politics. The position has also served as a grooming ground for up-and-coming politicians. At the same time, because of their great power, a U.S. attorney can take a person's life, liberty, and property when that person is prosecuted. U.S. attorneys are supposed to exercise prosecutorial independence. They're supposed to be insulated from partisan politics, and likewise, they are supposed to be independent. At certain points in the American legal, in the American system, in principle, we make a separation between politics and law. David Iglesias served as U.S. attorney for the District of New Mexico from 2001 to 2007. Previously, he was a judge advocate general, that is, a military lawyer in the Navy. He also worked in the New Mexico Attorney General's office. He also ran as the Republican candidate for Attorney General of New Mexico in 1998. He lost that race, but he came to the attention of longtime powerful Republican Senator Pete Domenici, who acted as his mentor and his patron and helped secure his appointment by President Bush to the Office of U.S. Attorney General, of U.S. Attorney for New Mexico. Generally speaking, U.S. attorneys hold their positions for the duration of a presidential term. They are very rarely let go in midterm. Nonetheless, Despite fine reviews of his work, Mr. Iglesias and six other U.S. attorneys were dismissed in December of 2006. This highly unusual happening and the mystery around the reasons for the dismissal provoked a political firestorm in 2007 that led eventually to the resignation of then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. It also may have been a reason why Senator Pete Domenici did not seek re-election. But we still don't know the real reasons for the dismissals. Rumor has always been strong about inappropriate White House involvement. David Iglesias has written about this. There's a book signing after the event. He will be speaking tonight about these matters in this talk called Do the Right Thing, When Good Organizations Do Bad Things. Please welcome David Iglesias.
Thank you, Professor. And I'd like to also thank Provost Adler for his kind invitation and Shamara Madrid for tracking me down on the internet. I'm not easy to find, and when you find out what I'm doing now, you'll understand why. And I'd also like to thank Dean Smith of Cal Western, Shamara Madrid, and Peggy Ryan for keeping me on time. It's something that does not always happen. So I want to take about 30 minutes of your time. Thank you for caring about our system of justice in this country. Thank you for caring about the rule of law. I'm looking forward to hearing your questions as I join the panel in just a few minutes. But I will give you a summary of what happens when an institution such as the Justice Department, which I believe historically has been a good institution, does the wrong thing. And the foundational question is, how did this, which is my swearing in October of 2001, I don't know if the buildings in Manhattan and D.C. were still smoldering, but it was shortly after 9/11. But how did this absolute day of joy for me, in which I was going to be the chief federal law enforcement official of the District of New Mexico, become this, which was our testimony at the House of Representatives in March of 2007. And looking from left to right is Carol Lamb, the U.S. Attorney from the Southern District of California, myself, Daniel Bogdan, who was a U.S. Attorney from the District of Nevada, Paul Charlton, U.S. Attorney from the District of Arizona, Bud Cummings, the former U.S. Attorney from the Eastern District of Arkansas, and John McKay, U.S. Attorney from the Western District of Washington State. And as Professor Horowitz said, U.S. attorneys are political appointees, but no administration had ever fired that many midterm of its own appointees. And as we speak today, we're close to finding out the real reasons. In fact, just a couple days ago, I sent out an email to several national media reporters that I've been dealing with for the past 2 years. And the title of my email was Five Boxes, because there are five boxes that were recently produced from the White House Counsel's Office a month ago to Chairman John Conyers' staff in Washington, D.C. And in those boxes, presumably, are the reasons for our precipitous firing. Very briefly, since I have an interest in history, I'm sure some of you do too. There may be some undergrads here who are history majors. But the U.S. attorney position is actually mentioned in Section 2, Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, where the public official that is mentioned. The U.S. attorneys actually predate the Office of the Attorney General, which was added much later. And as Professor Horowitz stated, normally we serve the term of the appointing president. So if you're serving a one-term president, you typically serve 4 years. If it's two terms, you serve 8 years. Now, back in the old days, you would occasionally get U.S. attorneys that actually served several or two presidents. We had one in New Mexico who served President Nixon, Ford, and 2 years of President Carter. Now, that's a little bit unusual, but it's not unprecedented. And as mentioned earlier, it is extremely rare to fire a U.S. attorney. And the figures that I've seen from the Congressional Research Office show only 10 fired between 1980 and 2005. And when you figure there were a couple of hundred U.S. attorneys in that period of time. 10 is a minuscule number. And misconduct is the most common reason United States attorneys are fired. And you may ask, well, what does misconduct mean? Well, in the case of the former U.S. attorney from Miami, he lost a big case, went to a strip club, and bit the leg of a stripper, which is assault and battery. It's an unlawful touching, and he was fired. There was another U.S. attorney. I'm not picking on Florida because I actually like Florida. I like to visit. But there's another United States attorney from Tampa, from the Middle District, who lost another big case. A reporter puts a mic in his face. And I've seen this videotape, so this is not an urban myth. I've seen the videotape from his successor. And he didn't like the question that the reporter asked. So he grabbed the reporter's necktie and shook it like this, which was also arguably an unlawful touching and constitutes battery. And he was also fired. And more recently, I'm aware of a U.S. attorney in the Bush administration. This is not public, but it should be, from one of our southern states, who was so enamored of one of his friends running for public office that he sent a press release announcing the investigation of his friend's opponent in the political campaign. He was advised against it by his first assistant. He was advised against it by his press officer. So he went home and sent the fax from his personal fax machine. Well, that's arguably politicking, because it turns out that his friend won the election in part because his opponent was being investigated. So this gentleman was asked to step down. So those, ladies and gentlemen, are examples of misconduct. And this part of my presentation is really for the undergrads who are thinking about maybe a career in public service or a career in which they want to do something meaningful. And I had a chance early on to not do anything. And I really thought long and hard about remaining silent, because I wanted to run for public office after my stint as U.S. attorney, and I figured I had a shot at it. But the more I thought about what had happened to me and my colleagues, I knew it was wrong. I knew enough about the history of the office to understand that United States attorneys had to be characterized by two things. If you remember anything from tonight, remember these two words: integrity and independence. We have to be independent. U.S. attorneys have to have the ability to independently exercise their prosecutorial discretion, because they're in the best position to review the evidence. So I thought about it. This was my test. This happened 23 years after graduation from law school. And I thought to myself, I can do the wrong thing and remain silent, or I can do the right thing and join my colleagues in testifying about what happened. And I'll tell you, I have no regrets for speaking out. And there have been consequences, and I'll get into those consequences shortly. My test came in the second term of the Bush administration. I served 4 years, wonderful 4 years, and people ask me how I like being a United States attorney. I tell them, but for the last 3 months, it was a great job. Because the last 3 months, it was time for me to look for another job. But I had no idea that what happened to us would become national news, and when it became national news, that it would remain national news for months. And now here we are 2 years later, and I'm still getting media inquiries. I've had to recently, because of scheduling difficulties, turn down appearances on Keith Olbermann and on Rachel Maddow and on Hardball, not because I dislike them, but because I couldn't get to their studios on time. But I never saw this coming. When I received two very inappropriate phone calls, which I'll get into in more detail, I never saw it coming. There was no warning whatsoever. And I had no chance to prepare and research and write a memo and tell them I'd get back to them. And being a Navy guy, and I need to tell you, since I've been mobilized, I need to tell you that all my comments are strictly personal, so please don't interpret anything I say as an official position of any component of the U.S. government. But I was doing some reserve duty on December 7th, a day that will live in infamy, personally for me. I was flying back from Newport, Rhode Island, where, ironically, I was teaching the rule of law to coalition partners from many countries, to friendly intelligence officers, law enforcement and prosecutors, and Ministry of Defense officials from a lot of different countries. I was flying home at the Baltimore-Washington Airport on Southwest Airlines when I got a BlackBerry message from my secretary saying, please call Mike Battle right away. Mike Battle was the former U.S. attorney from Buffalo, New York. He was the head of the Office of Executive that executed policy for U.S. attorneys. He was a friend. So I called Mike Battle, and he got right to the point, which I appreciated, as much as you can appreciate a call like that. Those of you that remember the movie Kramer versus Kramer, the scene in which the wife gets sick on the street, that's kind of how I felt, although I was indoors. It was a complete shock. It was a kick to the solar plexus. And I asked Mike when he said it was time to go a different direction and they wanted my resignation effective 7 weeks. I said, Mike, what is going on here? What did I do? Is there a problem? If there's a problem, tell me what it is. I can fix the problem. And Mike gave me words that still probably haunt him to this day. And that is, I don't know. And I don't want to know. All I know is it came from on high. And the on high portion told me it probably came from the Attorney General's office. At that point, it was Alberto Gonzalez. Or maybe from the White House. And I thought to myself, what unpardonable sin have I committed to be asked to step down when I knew the history of the office? And initially, I thought I was the only schmuck asked to step down out of 93 U.S. attorneys. All the other 92 are doing fabulous jobs and can stay for another couple of years. And I thought, what have I done? Needless to say, the four-hour flight back to Albuquerque was the longest four-hour flight of my life. And as a friend of mine who is a retired Penn State political science professor told me when I asked him point blank, he said that no other administration had fired so many of its own U.S. attorneys. And that's also what the Office of Inspector General's report that the Justice Department released in September said. This is unprecedented. And I'm glad there are so many of you here in this audience that understand why this is such a serious matter. Because justice cannot be compromised. Political appointees, especially United States attorneys, fill an important role in enforcing federal law. Primarily along the southwest border states, immigration prosecutions, narcotics prosecutions, large drug trafficking organizations get taken down. In my own district, we have a lot of Indian country. We have 22 Native American reservations. The felony crimes on those reservations are prosecuted by the Justice Department. So we were, in many cases, the only agency willing and able to do complex public corruption investigations and prosecutions. And I note something that you all know, if you're from the San Diego area, that Randy Duke Cunningham was prosecuted by a U.S. attorney, by Carol Lamb. And you think he received an eight-year sentence. So a very serious job. And one other disturbing trend about my colleagues and I is virtually all of us had one of two things going on in our districts. We had pending corruption investigations. I did. Carol did. She was looking at Dusty Fago from the CIA. Paul Charlton was investigating former Congressman Rick Renzi. And I'll get into a little bit of detail of another inappropriate phone call that Charlton received. Or voter fraud. There were allegations of massive voter fraud going on in New Mexico. I've written extensively about that. Because I actually believe there to be significant voter fraud issues. Systemic, district-wide voter fraud, large enough to affect the outcome of the election. But you know, something funny happens when you look for evidence. It's either there or it's not. It's either provable or it's not. And in my case, I couldn't find any cases I could prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So I didn't file any prosecutions related to voter fraud. John McKay had the same issue. If you recall from Seattle, if anybody's from Seattle, the gubernatorial race from just a few years ago in which there was three recounts. The final recount, I think the margin was 140 votes or something. Well, there were some in the party that were convinced that McKay should initiate and prosecute voter fraud. And John, like me, looked for it. But without evidence, you can't prove anything. So John did not file any voter fraud prosecution. So I was the first to admit that I'd been fired. And my hand was forced because two investigative journalists in New Mexico had heard through the grapevine that I'd received phone calls. And my first instinct was to say no comment, but I've received enough media training to know that that's the last thing you want to say to somebody who's on a hot story. So I kind of took a deep breath and I said, yes, I have. And the local media covered that story. It got picked up a little bit on the wires. And then Bud Cummings, the former U.S. attorney from Little Rock, talked to me a few days later and he said, you know, I decided to go public too. Because initially, we were just going to go away quietly. What is that line from Independence Day? Go quietly into the nighttime. That was our initial plan. But that didn't happen, obviously. And then John McKay was the first to actually leave office. In mid to late December, John sent out an email to every United States attorney saying he was moving on. And that's a tradition among outgoing U.S. attorneys. You announce your resignation, you tell your colleagues what a great new job you have, whether it's being corporate counsel or federal judge or whatever it is, and information where you can be reached. Well, John's didn't have any indication of where he was going. So I thought, this is really odd because McKay's a sharp guy. I wonder if he got the same phone call I did. So I just emailed John. I said, did you get the same phone call I did? And John emailed right back saying, I did, and I've heard there are 12 more. And John always has better intel than I do. I don't know what it is about Seattle, but they have better intel up there than Albuquerque. So I said, who are they? And John gave me a list of those he believed had been fired. So I had a little time on my hands. I decided to call those 10 people. And most of them had, in fact, received inappropriate or had received that same call on Pearl Harbor Day. So John and I connected. And then Carol and John and Charlton in Arizona had connected. And then we decided, well, let's start a chat. Now, my name was the last to be placed on the list. And if any of you have troubles with insomnia and want something to help you go to sleep, tpmmuckraker.com has a fabulous timeline that goes on for many, many pages. And one of the things you'll see is I was never on any list to be fired until after the phone calls I got from Domenici and Wilson. And then my name was first placed on the list on Election Day. I believe when the evidence is finally out, because it became clear at that point I wasn't going to file any voter fraud case. And the Office of the Inspector General, which is OIG, and Office of Professional Responsibility, which is OPR, called my case in their report the most troublesome. And the complaints about me were voter fraud and public corruption, that I wasn't moving quickly enough on the voter fraud and public corruption cases. And the complainants were the state party chairman and some activist lawyers, which I believed had been my friends. And if I ever do this presentation again, Provost Adler, I will memorize some lines from King Richard V about the merry band, whatever that wonderful piece of Shakespeare is. But instead of calling it a band of brothers, it's a band of prosecutors. Because we, as I mentioned, set up email chats, even conference calls. And we all agreed to keep our powder dry unless the dreaded P word was raised. And by P word, I mean performance. That if anybody from the Justice Department alleged performance, the gloves would come off. This is a graph taken from the Washington Post. And as you can see, I'll just read just some of this. In the case of Daniel Bogdan, who's next to me, overall evaluation was very positive. These are direct quotes. Case of Charlton, well-respected. Bud Cummings, very competent. Carol Lamb, an effective manager, respected leader. McKay, effective, well-regarded. Margaret Chiara, classy, distinguished, well-regarded. So I knew early on that performance had nothing to do with our termination. And I also include Todd Graves. Todd Graves was the U.S. attorney from Kansas City, which is the Western District of Kansas. And Todd had also had allegations of systemic voter fraud. He looked into it, didn't find anything, didn't prosecute any cases. And Todd was asked to resign by Mike Battle also, but in January of the same year we did. And I believe he was a beta test that the administration wanted to see if they could get away with firing a U.S. attorney and have suffered no consequence. So Todd left quietly, to his credit. And then Cummings in Little Rock was 6 months later, in late June, early July. And Cummings was, he'd run for Congress. So it's not like he's this wild, on-hair liberal Democrat. You know, he was a conservative Republic from Arkansas who had been asked to step down, and he was willing to do so. But what happened in my case was very different because I had no warning. There was no memo from the Justice Department, no warning from anybody saying, you know, you really need to get your act together, David. But I did receive, in October of 2006, in the midst of midterm elections, a race in which a friend of mine named Heather Wilson, who was a Rhodes Scholar and an Air Force Academy grad, was behind in the polls. And the lady who was challenging her was the sitting Attorney General of New Mexico, who in the small world category had beat me previously when I ran for Attorney General. And one of the things Heather Wilson had did was make a big deal out of the fact that the Attorney General had not filed one public corruption indictment her 8 years as Attorney General. So when Heather Wilson called me on my cell phone, she wanted to know about sealed indictments. And based on how she phrased her question, I knew she wanted to know about the sealed indictments that I had allegedly sealed relative to a prominent Democrat in New Mexico who had been an office holder for many years, who was reputed to be corrupt. His name was Manny Aragon, or Aragon, if you will. And I was investigating Manny, but the case wasn't ready to file. And Heather Wilson, despite the fact she was a member of Congress, had no need to know that information. In fact, I was prohibited from giving her that information. So I didn't tell her anything. 2 weeks later, I get a call from my mentor, and that's my former mentor, Pete Domenici, who the New Mexico media used to call St. Pete. And Domenici wanted to also know about this case involving Manny Aragon. He wanted to know if I was going to file any public or any indictment related to public corruption he'd been reading about before November. Well, what happens in November of a midterm election? That's when the election is. And he didn't have to spell that out to me exactly what he wanted. And I kind of sputtered out, well, I didn't think so. And then he said, well, I'm very sorry to hear that, and he hung up the phone. Within 2 weeks, my name is added on the list, and I'm fired. So as I was able to figure out later, as I'm crying in my hot tub, I could have compromised and given up this information, but I would have, as the Harper's Magazine has pointed out, I could have also been prosecuted for violating my oath and giving up confidential information. Unfortunately, I reflexively did the right thing, but I did get fired. And I've already covered this slide, so I won't go any more about that. But I will tell you about other members of Congress that made inappropriate phone calls. Doc Hastings is a member of Congress from Washington State. His chief of staff called John McKay and wanted to know if they were going to file any voter fraud cases. And McKay stopped him mid-sentence and said, you're not going to ask me for anything inappropriate because we both know that that's not proper. And he stopped that in the tracks. Paul Charlton's press officer received a phone call from the press officer of Rick Renzi, wanting to know if Renzi was being investigated, which is an incredibly inappropriate question to ask a U.S. Attorney's Office because we can't comment on whether or not somebody is being investigated. And Charlton's press officer didn't give it up, reported it to Charlton, who reported it to the Justice Department. But magically, that phone call wasn't released when information was released from the Justice Department to the Senate Judiciary Committee. There was no mention of that call from Renzi. So the one regret I have about this is I should have reported my phone calls. And I go into that in my book. I should have done that. I regret that. Ultimately, I think using the Charlton model, it wouldn't have made a difference. I would have been fired anyway. But I should have maintained that policy from the U.S. Attorney's Manual. So I didn't give out any confidential information. I didn't rush any indictment because, frankly, they weren't ready to go. What is that old commercial from, maybe it's Mogan David from the 70s, "We will sell no wine before it's time"? Well, any good prosecutor will not file any indictment before it's time. You're asking for disaster when you do that. And there was no use of any law enforcement sensitive data for political gain. I might add that Heather Wilson won by 800 votes. She squeaked it out. But I probably, if you want to see how a debate can make a difference, Google debate and Patricia Madrid, and you can see 7 seconds of silence after Heather Wilson asked her a question in which she completely freezes and for 7 seconds doesn't know the answer to this question. If elected to Congress, will you raise our taxes? This picture on your left is a picture of me with charts. As you can tell, I'm visually oriented. When I try cases, I always have charts and graphs. This was my last press conference, my last day as United States Attorney, because word on the street was I wasn't doing very well as a U.S. Attorney, so I wanted to disabuse the New Mexico media of that notion. I wanted to show them that the conviction rates were going up and that the number of cases were going up despite a smaller staff. And the performance-related quote comes from the former Deputy Attorney General, Paul McNulty, who's pictured on the right-hand side. So within one business day of my press conference, I get a phone call from some staffers in Washington, D.C., wanting to know if I would volunteer to testify on Capitol Hill. And I said, no, I'm not going to volunteer, but if you subpoena me, I know what a subpoena is. I'll show up and testify. So I got served by fax subpoenas. And I testified with three other U.S. attorneys in the Senate in the morning, and then that afternoon with five other U.S. attorneys in the House. And I have to tell you, if any of you have ever been in front of C-SPAN for a long period of time, it's a draining experience. And maybe I'll get some hints from the theater department to help me cope with how to maintain my edge for a long period of time, but I was absolutely exhausted. The House and Senate also launched ethics investigations. There was an Office of Special Counsel complaint, which I believe part of it is still going on. I need to wrap that up. There was the Department of Justice Inspector General's and OPR investigation, which I mentioned was made public in September. And now this civil lawsuit, which is still pending between the House and former White House officials, including Karl Rove and Harriet Myers. So in the case of Pete Domenici, there was a finding by the Senate Ethics Committee that he was publicly admonished. I think it was called a public letter of partial admonition, which sounds pretty lawyerly. But in his preceding 34 years of service, he'd never been accused of any ethical wrongdoing. So this is a pretty significant hit for him. Alberto Gonzalez resigned in August. I wrote a piece for the LA Times in which I used a colloquialism from the desert Southwest about cowboying up. If you grew up on the ranch, you know, you probably heard the expression cowboy up. And I told Mr. Gonzalez it's time to cowboy up and do the right thing. Kyle Sampson, who's the gentleman to his right, was his chief of staff. He also resigned. In fact, he was one of the first to resign in the spring after our testimony. Paul McNulty, the deputy attorney general, resigned. Monica Goodling, who some of the media had fun with her first name, saying that we have a Monica problem here, a veiled reference to the other Monica under the Clinton administration. She has the dubious distinction of being the only Justice Department official to ever testify under a grant of immunity from Congress. And, of course, Karl Rove resigned. And if you believe the writings of a book called Under Machiavelli's Shadow, that author argues that Rove resigned because the U.S. attorney scandal was the last straw that broke that camel's back. And one of the interesting things about the OIG-OPR report is there was a special counsel appointed. Nora Danahy is the acting U.S. attorney from Connecticut, and she's convened a grand jury in Washington, D.C., and she's taking evidence. And her job is to see if there are any criminal violations related to our firing. And you say, well, come on, you're a bunch of political appointees. What criminal violations could there possibly be? Well, obstruction of justice can include removing U.S. attorneys for corrupt reasons. speeding up indictments, trying to pressure somebody. In the actual language is to corruptedly influence would include that. Perjury, obviously, is a possibility for Mr. Gonzalez. I've already talked about the letter of admonition. The minute he retired, even though earlier that year he was campaigning for a seventh term, Heather Wilson ran, and this is really ironic. She stepped down from her House seat and was going to run to take Domenici's seat in the Senate, and she was beat in the primary. And the Republican candidate in New Mexico, who's a friend of mine, lost to Tom Udall, who's another friend of mine and a former boss of mine. So, you know, as much as you try to keep politics away from me, they have a tendency of haunting you like a ghost. And I'm excited about the possibility of new law and executive privilege. The last time the United States Supreme Court issued opinion was United States versus Nixon, which was issued in 1974. And that does, in fact, recognize executive privilege, which for non-lawyers, it allows the president to withhold information from Congress, even though Congress has a legitimate oversight responsibility. But it limits it to diplomatic and state secrets. And what the prior administration was doing is trying to say that it also included not allowing Rove and Myers to testify about our firing. And I wrote a piece in Slate.com about the expansive nature of executive privilege and how it was being abused. Oh, by the way, this picture was taken when we were doing a media rollout in January of 2006 about the Patriot Act. So I had no idea that 12 months later I'd be asked to step down. Another unintended consequence of all this was media exposure. And I'm so glad I've had some media training, that I'm comfortable talking to the media. I'm able to talk in sound bites, although I think it drives my wife and daughters crazy. They like the explanation part. But I was able to go on lots of shows, write op-ed pieces. I did a first chat for the Washington Post. This book, which is being sold out there, is a direct result of that. And I can thank a San Diego resident for writing the book. Ruben Navarrete, your columnist who writes for your local paper here, called me up and said, you should write a book. And I told him I never thought I had anything important to say, which obviously changed in 2007. And he said, talk to my agent. She's up in Del Mar. She'll fix you up. So I did, and she did. The Inspector General's report vindicates me and most of my colleagues. So that was a good thing. It talked about every reason they reviewed for my forced resignation, for my firing. They called it a disingenuous after-the-fact rationalization. The process was fundamentally flawed, and it recommended further criminal investigation. So to you young people in the audience who are thinking about public service or prosecution, be prepared to pay the price for doing the right thing. As my parents taught me many years ago when I was a child, right is right even if nobody's doing it. Wrong is wrong even if everybody's doing it. And honor, courage, and commitment have real-world meanings, not just empty words. I'd like to close this quoting an iconoclastic fighter pilot who, remarkably, if you read his book, made it to the rank of colonel. He used to stand outside his office in the Pentagon and scream to people walking by, outside, business as usual. Inside, fire and lightning. Because he came up with these incredible ideas. And Boyd was a book that Paul Charlton gave me, and I didn't read it for the first year. But I finally read it, and it was incredibly inspirational. And Boyd, who just died a few years ago, said, when your boss asks you for loyalty, give him integrity. When he asks you for integrity, give him loyalty. In other words, everything you do in service ought to be characterized by integrity. And I want to thank you for your attention. I look forward to answering the questions when the members of the panel come up stage. Thank you very much.
We're going to have a couple of comments. First is Professor Valerie Hartooni from the Department of Communication. She's a professor, been around for 15 or 16 years at UCSD. And after her will be Glenn Smith, a professor of constitutional law at California Western School of Law.
through the narrative frame that you've provided this evening, yours is a compelling story of an individual who finds himself under scrutiny and indictment by a political regime whose policies he sought to implement faithfully and understood himself to be implementing faithfully. An individual finds himself in the midst of a breathtaking spectacle of abuse and corruption, and he was eventually forced to speak truth to power, whatever the professional or political consequences. Despite quite explicable moments of equivocation about so speaking, Mr. Iglesias describes himself as finally motivated to do the right thing, to take a principled stand and act in service of justice and ultimately the Constitution because it was the right thing to do. And about this, I couldn't agree with him more. But there are several things that disturb me about the account that Mr. Iglesias has offered this evening and developed more comprehensively in his book. And these leave open for me the question of whether you ended up doing the right thing primarily because there was really nothing else you could have done. Whether the issue was, as you presented, a question of principle, or rather a question primarily of defending your reputation or good name. The two needn't be mutually exclusive, but I do wonder about whether and to what extent corruption within the U.S. judicial system would have moved you to act in the ways that you did had you not been dismissed without recourse or professionally discredited. And what leads me to raise these questions is this. You describe being contacted in October 2006 by Heather Wilson, who, although wrongly informed, was fishing for privileged information about sealed indictments she believed you had recently filed, and you report being shocked, irritated, and even insulted by her overture. And I want to read the account you give of this moment in your book. You put it this way. In retrospect, my reaction might have rather been one of considerable moral outrage. As annoyed as I was and as evasive in my responses I became, the fact remained that Wilson had stepped over the line, and I would have been well within my rights to report her to the House Ethics Committee. Knowing how the system worked, I wasn't sure what blowing the whistle on Wilson would accomplish, especially considering my own precarious position within the party. Suffice to say, the nagging unease that I felt from Wilson's highly inappropriate and even illegal phone call would take on a whole other dimension a couple of weeks later. Mr. Iglesias then goes on to describe, as he's done tonight, the subsequent phone call from his mentor or political patron, former Senator Pete Domenici. Sorry. Who is clearly soliciting highly privileged information about the indictments. Wilson had inquired after, specifically whether they would be filed by the election. What he was asking was patently improper, you say, and unethical, and although your response to Domenici was minimal, you did not think indictments would be filed. Offering just that information alone, you recognized as compromising. For a host of reasons, misplaced loyalty, a sense of hierarchy, obedience, and duty to individuals you regarded as your commanding officers, fear of reprisal, a desire to protect your job and promising political future, you opted to do nothing about Domenici's indiscretions. So these critical moments in October when, as you say in your book, the Republican Party was cutting corners and bending rules to rescue its dream of permanent political hegemony, you were uncomfortable and fearful for your job, but you chose to accommodate the ruse of power. And it seems you were willing to remain silent and continue to accommodate a number of glaring ethical lapses and what was becoming obvious to you as a corruption within the judicial system, even after you were wrongly fired, so long as Maine justice avoided disparaging your record and adversely affecting your employment prospects. And here I begin to wonder, what about your fealty to the Constitution and the sworn oath, your sworn oath to uphold it? Had Maine justice been less inept in the aftermath of your dismissal, seems clear, or is it clear, that neither you nor the other attorneys would have taken the matter public. And in your book, at least, you regard the silence you and the other attorneys maintained in the immediate aftermath of the firings as, and I quote, an impressive achievement. But in what sense was this silence impressive? The administration, its representatives, perhaps even the White House under cover of Homeland Security, and specifically the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, had devised a scheme to institutionalize across the various branches of government a single partisan agenda. Some might call this fascism. It certainly is a subversion of the Constitution you were sworn to protect. And perhaps I'm naive, but I don't understand why you and the other attorneys were still seeking the blessings of Maine justice, even after it became clear to you that the ethical foundations of the institution you were sworn to serve were being undermined. I don't quite understand why you agreed to speak out only if you personally and collectively were slandered. In his 2008 book, What Happened, former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan suggests that a culture of deception has come to permeate Washington. And he attributes the growth of this culture to a variety of sources and pressures, hardly unique to the former administration, but in his view, nevertheless, fully exploited by it. And although you weren't in Washington, it seems to me that you, the Department of Justice, the Office of U.S. Attorneys, were clearly inadvertently and in many instances unwillingly drawn into the corrupting vortex of that culture. But I'm wondering what it means and tells us that individuals in a position to speak out about the corrosive arrangements, practices, understandings, and effects of this culture of deception opt to speak out only long after the fact and from the sidelines. And I'm thinking here about a long list of former public servants who left office, and this would include Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill, former CIA director George Tenet, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, former Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel Jack Goldsmith, and even Scott McClellan. Each of these individuals, in books they've written since their service, recite instance after instance in which they were called upon to compromise themselves, their office, their oath to the nation and its people, to give an administration whatever facts, figures, legal opinions, or findings it needed to advance an agenda it rarely felt compelled to explain or subject to serious public scrutiny or deliberation. The publication of these after-the-fact accounts seemed to me only to sharpen one's cynicism and enhance one's despair about the continued prospects for democratic self-governance. These were individuals in a position to know what stories were being fabricated, what facts were being cooked, what public trust was being both manipulated and squandered, and what political worlds were being fundamentally transformed in the process. And they held their peace until speaking truth to power didn't matter in the way it might have or should have, until speaking truth to power could be dismissed as the exaggerated ramblings of a disgruntled former employee. And I know individuals sought to discredit your testimony in precisely this way. And so I wonder, because it's ambiguous in your text, despite the conviction you've presented us tonight, that right is right even if no one is doing it, and wrong is wrong even if everyone is doing it. I wonder this: if Maine Justice had backed off in mid or late January of 2007 and sought to reinstate you, knowing what you knew by that time about corruption within the U.S. judicial system, would you have acquiesced and resumed your position as a U.S. attorney? With your job intact and future professional prospects assured, would right still seem to be obviously right in precisely the ways you've described this evening?
Let me just leave you with three short observations. And the first is that I think that this experience shows you that there is an important but limited role of law to deal with the kind of problems, the kind of unique problems, really, that the U.S. attorney's position in the government and the political system create. My second point is that there's an important yet episodic role for politics to play. And third, therefore, the critical role is the role of individuals. And there's been addressed both in the initial remarks and Professor Hartone's comments. First, with regard to the important yet limited role of law, obviously law can create some structure against which this drama unfolded. As Attorney Iglesias pointed out, there's statutes about obstruction of justice and perjury. There's, as his book points out, there's three very short provisions in the U.S. Code that kind of represent the fundamental awkward trade-off. The U.S. attorneys are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. They're appointed to a four-year term, but the president can remove them, not necessarily for cause, at the pleasure of the president. And so there's this kind of trade-off or uncertainty that's built into the statute, which the statute really doesn't do more than that, I'll say, to deal with. Also, there is constitutional law doesn't have a lot of clear terrain to point out here. There is an inherent separation of powers tension in the U.S. Attorney Office. Obviously, We do expect continuity. We expect the rule of law. We expect certain aspects of prosecution to exist from administration to administration. And yet, on the other hand, as Attorney Iglesias has pointed out, U.S. attorneys have an important policymaking role to play. And it, in our system, would be thought to be inappropriate politically, as also might be questionable constitutionally, if we tried to limit the ability of the incoming president to have his or her influence and his policymaking agenda hampered by not being able to have his people in this important role. You know, I was thinking about this, in fact, just in terms of the way the government is usually structured, U.S. attorneys are very unusual. Either one model, of course, is the presidential appointee who's confirmed by the Senate, but not for any particular term and can be fired for any reason at any time. And then there's the for-cause member of, say, a Federal Regulatory Commission or some kind of body where they are appointed to a fixed term. And yes, they can be removed, but there has to be cause, and that's a fairly high standard. Well, the U.S. attorney, we have the unusual situation where we have an office where there is a term and an expectation, and yet no requirement that the person be fired for cause. And in fact, as I pointed out, there would be political and legal and perhaps even constitutional problems under Supreme Court precedents that emphasize that the president and the executive branch must retain a significant role in riding herd on and calling the shots about the execution of law in our separated power system. So there's really a limit to what law can do in terms of this difficult compromise that Attorney Iglesias well describes in the book and others have described. The second thing, well, then maybe if law and political structure can't come to our aid, politics can. And certainly, as the PowerPoint pointed out, and as those of you who even followed at a brief level know, there were we owe in a significant part that this story has progressed the way it has to the fact that there were there were members of the House and the Senate that took this story seriously, that were well placed in committees to investigate this and to keep the drumbeat going for getting to the bottom of the situation. It was reflecting, though, that it's very clear that we have divided government to thank for that. The Democrats not been in control of Congress because of the midterm change in 2006, we might have had a very different political dynamic at work. I would like to think that, and certainly the leadership role of Arlen Specter as key Republican senator on the Judiciary Committee, as Attorney Iglesias lays out in his book, helps me think that there might have that even a Republican-dominated Judiciary Committee might have taken that seriously. But it certainly helped significantly that the Democrats were in a position to call the hearing, ask the questions, lead the charge, et cetera. That contrasted, by the way, with in the previous Congress when a provision in the Patriot Act was adopted that looked rather innocuous and, as Attorney Iglesias describes in the book, had the effect of allowing the president to replace the U.S. attorney with an interim appointee who could serve indefinitely. That was not Congress at its final hour, as the House report indicates, another matter indicates, that provision was snuck into the conference committee and had a one-line explanation in the conference report. So, as I said, the political protection can be episodic. It certainly can be strong, but it's certainly not a guarantee. So that leaves us with the personal, and I think that is the point I would leave you with, which is we can try to have law have the best balance and the best protection of the independence and the integrity of U.S. attorneys while preserving their political responsiveness to a new administration and a new change in policy. We can hope for political structures that pull for the protecting of people that have integrity and independence, but ultimately, as pointed out, we have to ultimately put our trust and our faith in individuals and their sense of integrity and good judgment. I have to say that I found it refreshing to the extent to which Attorney Iglesias reflected his honest doubts about the ethical issues and divided loyalties. There was a mentor, a senator who had been responsible for his appointment in some ways was a highly regarded figure and may have had a one-day lapse or something. I'm not defending it, and obviously it's up to him to do that, but I think it is a bit refreshing to know that to have him admit in the book that he may not have made all the right decisions. He may have been slow to decide to do the right thing. He may have felt buffeted by the kinds of forces that all of us, I think, or many of us, I'll say, would be, I know I would, be buffeted by. And I think that the fact that, you know, as one of the framers of the Constitution said, the only problem with government is that, you know, men are not angels. And I would include women now as well, although I know some women who are angels. But still, they're, you know, we depend on individuals to find their angelic nature, maybe slowly, maybe episodically, but and then to stand up against the forces of darkness and illegality and unconstitutionality. And I think that's maybe the final takeout of this whole episode, not just for Attorney Iglesias, but for the others involved, the other U.S. attorneys, the members on Capitol Hill, the members in the Justice Department, the Inspector General, all those people who individually have contributed by their sense of ethics to the what will hopefully be an ultimate happy ending to the story, in which we will be able to count on independence and integrity for a long time to come. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, David Iglesias. It's been a very good Higgs lecture. We'll see you next year.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.